Hi everyone, Namu Myoho Renge Kyo. Thank you for being here. I'm not sure how today's lecture is going to go. Might get a little long. And if you don't have time for the whole thing, please go ahead and pause it or save it, download the podcast, and make sure you come back to it and listen to the whole thing, because I'm going to cover a lot of ground. And some of it may sound familiar, but for some of you who are asking questions and using Nagarjuna as your point of departure, I feel like I need to straighten the record a little bit. And so that's what I'm going to endeavor to do here in this video. And I think what I'm going to talk about isn't specifically politically about Nagarjuna, but about Buddhism and several of its main points, certainly main points that Nagarjuna was trying to nail down. So let me start by saying, Namu Myoho Renge Kyo. I've talked at length about what the meaning of those characters is. And in his own way, so does Nagarjuna. My goodness, what is going on? All right, so Nagarjuna, as a figure in Buddhism, is known as a bodhisattva, as a great scholar, and he's named other things to other sects of religious practice that attach a lot of their meaning to Shinran and other scholars, and they pick apart Nagarjuna and use him as a foundational reason for other teachings that they introduce and pile on. I'm talking to you, Zen. I'm talking to you, True Word and True Land and Nembutsu. Just as Nichiren did not create new Buddhism, Nichiren was a reformer of existing Buddhism, of Shakyamuni's Buddhism. Nichiren was very strict about redirecting the erroneous path and views of other sects calling themselves Buddhism, but with whatever other added feature they gave themselves, whether it was True Land, True Word, Nembutsu, Amida, Buddhism, whatever. They're all claimed to be Buddhist schools, but upon closer analysis, as Nichiren provided, they had deviated. They did not understand the fundamental path to awakening, enlightenment. Many, like the Jains, we're still stuck on the body, the self, the eternal self, the life after life, reincarnation, all of that. That's not Buddhism. But it seems like every couple hundred years, some scholar, and I'm sure he or she was not, well, he in the history of Buddhism, but it doesn't have to be that way anymore, right, ladies? Many people who studied Buddhism understood that there were a lot of erroneous, a lot of baloney going on, simply for claims of superiority or political advantage. I mean, still to this day, Shoshu does the same thing, right? And SGI, my God, that is a political party. So you don't have to look far to see how Buddhism has been used to push other agendas, right? Well, the reason I say all of this isn't to start railing political and rah, rah, rah. I just want to point out, and it's something that you guys need to keep clear in your mind when you're studying outside of Nichiren's or Shakyamuni's specific words, other scholars, whether they're in the Buddhist lineage, like Tendai and Maolo and Dengyo and Vasubandhu and Nagarjuna and others, you need to continually remind yourself of what I'm going to talk about today. Also, English, American, French, German, Italian scholars that have translated and investigated these teachings from early teachings to later. They too bring their cultural identities into the mix. So always, always, I know I harp on this a lot, but it's very easy. And this is exactly part of what Nagarjuna teaches, that our attachment mentality, our mechanism of our samsaric identity, our humanness, is so obsessed and automatic about making things permanent and known, like facts, and these days, alternative facts, whatever the hell that is. There's a lot of that in Buddhism throughout its history. We need to be able to discern that, to understand we're entering into a forest of great merit and great intense knowledge that is also affected and sometimes influenced by these other agendas. It's just, it's life. That's why life is suffering, because that's a constant reality of samsara. And Nagarjuna, like Nichiren, like Tendai, like Dengyo, like every great scholar of Buddhism, Nagarjuna was trying to repair, reiterate, and regenerate the pure, clear teachings of Shakyamuni Buddha. There's no Nagarjuna Buddhism, just like there's no Nichiren Buddhism, although you'll see that on the websites. They are scholars of Shakyamuni's Buddhism because Shakyamuni is Buddhism. Any kind of Buddhism that claims to be other than Shakyamuni Buddhism, it isn't Buddhism. It's something else. It's real simple, but it's very easy to get lost in the words, especially with scholars like Nagarjuna, who are debaters extraordinaire. Remember, I told you he takes things to ad nauseum until you cannot refute his conclusion, because if you do, you fall into one of the categories that he's already shown is complete rubbish, his negations, right? So you'd have to be some kind of debater to be able to win with Nagarjuna. So it's especially concerning to people like you and I that people come later, once Nagarjuna is out of the way and can't argue with you, and reinterpret his stuff to mean what they want it to mean, like they're imbued with better insightful knowledge. It'll drive you crazy. I just want you to be aware of it. So I found this post, one of many online. A question came up. Nagarjuna is a scholar of Shakyamuni's teachings, Buddhism. And his main opus is the Madhyamika Karika, this deep investigation into what is emptiness. Not the void, that's a Zen term. and translations that use that word are wrong. He spoke of emptiness, and emptiness is a void is a very specific word. It points to something that, you know, when you pour concrete and there's air bubbles in it, you call that air bubble a void, where there exists no concrete, and it's a problem. Nothing is there. But that's not the same as emptiness, which is a little bit of a fuzzier word, right? It's like, you're familiar with the term crocodile tears. These are tears from a person who laments the loss of somebody or some negative act, and they're not sincere. They're just crying for appearance's sake. You call those crocodile tears, right? Why are you crying? You're happy. You're happy this happened. Why are you crying? It's insulting. That's not void. That's empty. Those tears are empty. They have no substance. But that's different than saying there's nothing there. There's definitely something there. Do you see the difference? This is what Nagarjuna was talking about, because he was trying to explain the nature of attachment, Shakyamuni's teachings of attachment. And his teachings of attachments were being distorted in Nagarjuna's day. And Nagarjuna wanted to put an end to it. He said, no, no, no. Attachment is an action that we in samsara take, and that's what suffering precipitates from. It's the act, unconscious act, the way we're designed to act, the way molecules are built. This attachment feature of physical samsaric universe process of life is fundamentally incurring and including with it the pain of suffering. Because where there's attachment, there's detachment. And detachment is always traumatic in some way. Makes sense, right? I mean, it makes sense when you speak. For us, it's very easy to understand this. In this latter day of the law, we're sophisticated thinkers. We know if we lose a finger, we're going to be traumatized. The pain we feel physically, mentally, emotionally is all due to the nature of attachment. So ask yourself how profound this nature of attachment is. So yeah, Nagarjuna spent a long time and a lot of dialogue and writings trying to squash this idea that attachment was something else, that it was given to you, or that it somehow manifested itself in this human life, when in fact it's the very process of life. The initiation of this universe is built on attachment. And so, like, one of the first quotes here of Nagarjuna's verses, and in this dialogue says, praising Amida Buddha and the easy path of the pure land. That statement, that's not Nagarjuna saying that. That's somebody interpreting Nagarjuna, and they're interpreting it completely wrong. Because you and I know from study that Amida Buddha is a conjured personage of Shakyamuni's to use as a straw man, a destination, as an exemplar of how the path of learning to be unattached and our subsequent enlightenment can be like. And he used Amida as a tool to teach this path. Remember, people of his day couldn't wrap their minds around Shakyamuni the man and Shakyamuni the Buddha. They kept saying the Buddha or the Lord, which is more true, although Lord is a westernization, the great saint from the Shakya clan, Shakyamuni, the one who has attained what others have never attained, the thus come one, the Tathagata, Buddha, mind state, Buddha, state of knowledge, state of knowing, state of experience, not attached to a body, but in this case, attached, if you will, to Shakyamuni, only to show that this state of unattachment is within the realm of the samsaric body. Not that it is a body. You can see already, just trying to use words to define the difference, it can be confusing. And so one of the examples that Shakyamuni used was Amida. That when you attain what Amida has attained, like when the lion in the Wizard of Oz gets there and he finds out that he had courage all along, he just didn't know it. That's, you can easily turn that into a Buddhist story. But the walking, talking lion who goes merrily down the yellow brick road with Dorothy, it's a story. We should not go to the depths of Africa and hunt down an enlightened lion so that we could find out what he already knows. Because believe you me, by the time you find out, you will be lion chowder. It's a little too late. Okay? So here's one of the quotes he uses to justify what he says. By means of this vehicle of the Eightfold Path, one can cross the ocean difficult to traverse. To save himself and to save others, I pay respect to the highest of men. I could do this whole video on that one statement alone. That's not about Amida Buddha. That's Shakyamuni's teachings. He's using an exemplar of somebody who has followed the life of the Eightfold Path. Remember, the Noble Eightfold Path, derived from the fourth of the Four Noble Truths. Living a life well, a man, not a spirit. And he says, pay respect to the highest of men, not a god, not an entity, which Amida never walked the earth. He was a conjured entity, a personage. One can cross the ocean difficult to traverse. Nichiren says the same thing. Cross the sea of suffering. In other words, the innumerable amounts of attachments that we are an instantiation of is like an ocean. And by our practice, we are traversing it. Remember the analogy, getting to the other shore? What is that other shore? Because we're humans and that's how we understand things. Well, it's the pure land, but it's not a different land. It's in here. The pure land of Amida Buddha is a realization that everything around you is enlightenment. It's not a different place. It's in your mind. The whole example, the whole stories, the abundant stories of Amida Buddha within the scope of Shakyamuni's teachings, which all are for samsara, nowhere outside of it, Amida Buddha is a figure who represents you and I attaining our enlightenment, and in so doing, re-perceiving, shifting our paradigm and re-perceiving the world we're in right now as a pure land, because it is. All the defilements, if you will, or the confusions or the negativities of the land we think we inhabit are in fact attachments that we guard as factual, and they're an illusion because none of it exists, not in perpetuity. And this is the shift in Buddhism that loses people. Sometimes it's talked about as the two truths. There is a truth to teach in samsaric mind. And then once you attain, you cross that border, you reach the other shore, you cross the ocean, whatever verbiage you want to put around it, that you finally go, aha, now I see, like my cornfield analogy, right? Everything becomes clear. Well, that's a different truth. It's not different as much as it's a shift in paradigm. It's a shift in perspective. It is what Buddhism is all about. Quite simply, changing your mind. And if you want to know why attachments are treated as such voluminous things, is because as humans, we tend to think as attachment as that chair or this painting or our mandala or this robe or our haircut. But in point of fact, what is it? You could correct me on this. You discuss it in the comments. It's been a while since I read on mitochondrial DNA. But I believe there's some ridiculous number, like 42 million chromosomes in a DNA strand. And remember, a DNA is a tiny, tiny little molecule. But it has within it these divisions that we can't even fathom how many cells are in our body, let alone the information molecule that programs them. And then go deeper than that. What makes those things? What makes those things? When do we get to an irreducible, tiny, ephemeral photon, fermion, boson? Let's make it easy. Electron, proton, neutron. How many are we composed of? Because each of those is part of our inertia, part of our being. We are being the summation of all those attractions, attachments, and expressions, manifestations, moment to moment. When you start thinking this way, then you start understanding Shakyamuni's resort to ground up the solar system, then ground up the entire Milky Way, and then take each one of those tiny dust particles of all of those billions of stars and start walking. And every time you pass another galaxy like Andromeda, drop one piece of dust and keep going. And then when you get done and you drop every piece of dust, already my mind's gone. I can't fathom that. But he goes on. This is Asamkaya, Nayuta, Kalpas, right? He just keeps adding these sums. Not because he wants you to be good at math. Because he's trying to explain to you that which you are conscious of is so much more immense than you allow your earthly samsaric mind to consider. You just blanket them with, these are mine, those are yours. That's as much as we can be bothered by the whole idea. And when we do that, we lose our footing. We misunderstand what's actually going on. And so what was Nagarjuna doing? He's trying to bring back that kind of granular thinking. This is another one about the boat. I want to jump around here because I don't want to read this whole thing. is another goal. This is goal setting. This is dedication to, what was it? I saw something earlier that really caught my eye. He who begins to think about this Buddha has his virtues and infinite power, entering immediately into the sure state of becoming a Buddha. You see, he's talking about Amida as the training tool to try to emulate what Amida has achieved. But Amida is not a real thing. It's a path. It's a goal. It's like getting a diploma. The diploma itself cannot go get a job. But that you've reached that level of accomplishment allows you, with the diploma as your proof, to qualify for a job. The diploma doesn't get the job. The diploma is not, it's just a record of accomplishment. That's Amida. This is more. For those who are born in this realm, this, I believe he's still talking about that Buddha realm. In that realm, all living beings have divine power of transformation, and those who study in their hearts are endowed with remembering their past. For those who are born in this realm, there is no longer me or mine. They are not born to such thoughts. Born to such thoughts. See, we hear the word born in the West and we think birth. Birth of a human, of a anything. But born in this sense is the instantiation of a thought. Remember 3,000 realms in a single thought moment? People weren't that sophisticated then. So they had to be understand that their thoughts are born and exist and die away, decay, right? I mean, they're still trying to incorporate these early ideas of Shakyamuni that were still eluding them, and it eludes us today. So it's, you know, this is samsara. It's very confusing. Once having left the prison of the three worlds, one has an appearance like the petals of a white lotus. Myoho Renge Kyo. He's actually invoking the Lotus Sutra here without saying it. The number of disciples is infinite. In other words, you would read boundless. The bodhisattvas of the earth. The living beings of this realm have the nature of this Buddha. They are gentle and harmonious. Spontaneously, they accomplish the 10 good actions or perfections. He's talking about bodhisattvas. This is why this is considered early Mahayana teaching. And then a bunch of teachers came around, started using this and deviating from Mahayana altogether. Basically, Hinayanas or Theravadist. And they were using these words incorrectly. Following on from their good actions, a pure light arises in them, incommensurable and infinite. They are the foremost among men, humans. They are bodhisattvas, the great beings. See, it tracks. If you just keep referring back, like bookends, Shakyamuni, Nichiren. From Shakyamuni, we have the teachings. From Nichiren, we have the great clarification. But the clarifications happened several times over thousands of years. And Nagarjuna takes his place as one of the initial clarifiers. If, listen carefully, if someone takes the vow to become a Buddha, right? When you get your mandala and you do the eye-opening ceremony and you vow, right? To take confidence in the teaching, to take confidence in the mandala of the teaching, Shakyamuni's teaching, and you take confidence in the entity of which you are the law, the Buddha, the clarity, the perfection of wisdom, the Buddha-ness, the Buddha mind. At the moment of this vow, oh, and thinks of Amida, thinks of Amida, thinks, capture in your mind the accomplishments of Amida, not a person, but his realm of consciousness, his attainment of Buddhahood, in the story that Shakyamuni gave you, at the moment of his vow, wishing, it's a vow, that's different than wishing, he will reveal his body to him. In other words, when you take the vow with your mandala of Myoho Renge Kyo, you will invoke Buddha. He's much more obvious about it. Similarity of their bodies and offers 10 directions. Oh, it's perfect. Perfect. He could be talking about chanting Daimoku when he says this. Again, everything in Buddhism, actual Buddhism, tracks flawlessly. They're just different words. This is why I pay respect and bow my head to him. 18. If someone cultivates the roots of wholesomeness, the Eightfold Path, lives righteously, lives in accord with life-affirming behaviors, thoughts, actions, right? But has doubt, his lotus does not open for him. His lotus does not open for him. The first teaching, Shakyamuni, the first sermon he gave, although he gave up on it a couple, 3 weeks into it because nobody was perceiving him. What's it called? The flower garland? Based on a flower? What's his ultimate teaching called? The lotus, the wonderful lotus flower. Sometimes the wonderful white lotus flower. This symbolism of the aha, not only flourishing, blossoming that Buddha nature, but at the same time seeding itself into its environment. From the defiled confusion of a muddy swamp, a lotus flower comes up through the water, blossoms and spreads its seeds at the same time. Buddhahood, Bodhisattva, Buddha way. The seeds are Bodhisattva, are they not? They carry the Buddha way with them back into the soil to raise more Buddhas. This whole analogy of the lotus flower is key to a very fundamental mind shift that Shakyamuni has been talking about since he attained his own enlightenment. And full circle comes back around to it in his last years of teaching. This is what I've been telling you, the Lotus Sutra. So what does he say? If someone cultivates the roots of wholesomeness, lives correctly, but has doubt, his lotus does not open for him. His lotus does not open. His Buddha nature does not manifest. Upon becoming pure, his lotus opens for him, and then he sees the Buddha. This is why I've said in the past, to study Nagarjuna without first having understood the Lotus Sutra and how it comes about and what it means, as Nichiren helps us to understand, this doesn't have the same enlightenment, doesn't have the same power, doesn't have the same tract. But if you understand already what is the goal of Buddhism and you read Nagarjuna, you go, oh, he got it. He knew it. This is what we do when we invoke Myoho Renge Kyo. We invoke our Buddha. We see the Buddha. As Nichiren would say, single-mindedly fusing with mandala or wanting to see the Buddha, which is our own mind state. And here at the very day, this one may be a little harder to understand, but as I just read it, I'm thinking, yeah, these people who seized on this, like who's the guy I was mentioning, Shiran? Anyway, simply leaped over this quotation here without understanding it. The Buddhas who dwell in the 10 directions, Amida being one of them, in the middle of their diverse causes and conditions, are not able to vie with the virtues of this Buddha. So already he's relegated Amida as something that's a teaching, that's a useful stepping stone. But once you awaken and you then see the Buddha, when your lotus opens and you see the Buddha, Amida's no match. He's just a stepping stone that got you there. Understanding the teaching of Amida, as well as then the rest of the teachings of Shakyamuni, that story no longer has value. Well, that would destroy any Pure Land theorist, right? Or Nembutsu, certainly. I pay respects to the Buddha, not Amida. I pay respects to the feet of the Buddha. In the beginning, when he made the vow to become a Buddha, he made some things rare and marvelous. Thus is written in the sutra, in my turning towards him. By means of the vehicle of the Eightfold Path, one can cross the ocean, difficult to traverse, to save himself and others. I already read that. Why is that coming up again? Or is it, maybe it's repeated. That in my present or past life, I've gained, big or small, I wish to go to the realms of the Buddha and to have always a pure heart. Yeah. And they want to attribute this all to Amida Buddha and his Pure Land, when what they miss is that the teaching of Amida Buddha and reaching that Pure Land is a teaching for us to invoke for ourselves, taught by Shakyamuni. How many, I was going to say fables, but I don't mean fables. How many, what's the word I'm looking for? We have stories in the West. Some are fables, but there are stories that are meant to teach us ethics and moral codes, right? Everything from Goldilocks and the Three Bears to Crying Wolf, right? The Boy Who Cried Wolf, lying for attention. And then once you tell the truth, nobody believes you. They sound simple, but this is what Buddhism is made of. And so always, always when you study, understand who you're reading. Understand that the teachings of Buddhism come from one source, Shakyamuni, and that everyone else is either working to hone their scholarship on what Shakyamuni was saying, or trying to translate Shakyamuni's words into something that bends to their agenda. This is happening now. Not now as in me, now as in all these sects and groups and stuff. Many, many in the last couple of decades have spawned from cults and sects that left them out in the cold because they were transparent in their corruption. And so now we have thousands of independent Buddhists practicing Nichiren's doctrine. And I think that is amazing. That is a testament to what I'm trying to discuss here in this video. That first of all, the paths to Buddhahood are innumerous. And that all of us share some common foibles of samsara. And so it's critical that we talk amongst each other, because like stones in a tumbler, we can polish ourselves, clear up our understanding of Shakyamuni's teachings without having to resort to manipulation or one-upmanship, or who knows more than who knows less, or who's better, who's worse. We don't need that crap in Buddhism. It's antithetical to Buddhism, because we're all Buddha. We just have different paths to realize it. We're all lotus flowers, but we have different swamps that we're in, right? And Nagarjuna was really focused on getting people to understand, like I said, in the, like we're a dust cloud moving through. When I said that, a sandstorm, what I was attempting to say was that each particle of dust or sand in the sandstorm is itself an attachment, excuse me, or a group of attachments, and all together represents our entity moving through time. And we slough off some of these attachments as we go. Of course, we also gain some more in front of us. This is a visualization I was trying to make of what the Madhyamika is trying to teach. It's that the nature of attachment is so granular and so small that when you really consider the whole drama of it, that there is no your dust storm, your haboob. That it's a universe size attachment mechanism that you're just a little dot of moving through time. And that the act of attachment, the act of holding on, the act of possession, that's empty. Because what are you embracing? What are you holding on to? By the time your mind has established a hold, what you're holding is no longer there. It's an empty embrace. That's emptiness. Does that make sense? I hope so. I hope that changes your perception of emptiness as the void or of nothingness, because there's no such thing. This is samsara from the edges, every edge of this expanding universe to its center. It is manifestation All of it. These are the big questions scientists are struggling with to this very day. So you might reinvestigate the term empty space to mean not empty as in void or vacuum, but empty as in all the stuff we don't know. Or that we think we know. But there's that think problem again. That thought, that embrace of something that's already gone. Moment to moment, birth, death, birth, death, birth, death. That's emptiness. What you're hanging on to is empty. Stop investing so much emotion and effort in hanging on to stuff that's empty. By knowing this, you can take a giant step toward awakening. That doesn't mean you can't have fun with all this stuff. It just means that it's stuff that's ephemeral. It arises, it decays, it goes away. Everything, all phenomena is this way. This is the process that we're in. And that's what Nagarjuna's main teaching is about. And when he deigns to talk about other aspects of Shakyamuni's teachings, like perfection of wisdom, like Amida Amitabha, he is reiterating Shakyamuni's paths to Buddhahood, which he's obviated by his degree of scholarship in attachment theory, emptiness. But it's hard. Words are hard. Anyway, I've probably gone on. Well, not too bad. But I hope this opened a door for you. If nothing else, that you approach study with a different idea of what you're studying. Not everything you read is as read. Everything has a point, an agenda. And that agenda may not be the purification of thought of what Shakyamuni was teaching. It may be a way of using Shakyamuni's teachings to bolster a different point of view. It's not incredibly difficult to do that, given the profundity and the depth of understanding that are in the scholarship of Buddhism. But you need to watch out for it. And I think, as I said before, if you endeavor to understand the teaching of the Lotus Sutra fully, and I do mean when you run into something in the Lotus Sutra that seems like a shorthand, like there's more to know there, go investigate it. Find another sutra that talks about it specifically. And it'll disassemble it so that you can come back to the lotus and go, ah, I see how that fits. With that kind of understanding, our modern understanding, when you then say, well, I'm bored, I think I'll read some Vasubandhu, you'll be able to see Vasubandhu clearly. But if you go and look for some esoteric Chan expert in China who's teaching something that has a label called Buddhism, but it isn't, and you're looking for answers about your practice to Buddhism there, you will be deceived. Or let me just say, it'll be easy for you to fall into doubt and bad habits. Just stay aware of what you're doing. I heard this many, many years ago. Somebody always said, consider the source. I don't know where that came from, but it's a very important little light to keep in your mind as you approach your studies. Okay? I'm going to let it go with that. Thank you so much for listening, for participating, for contributing, for asking questions. Thank you, Al. Your support is everything. Sorry. And everything is you. I can't help it. Motown. Anyway, have a great day. Stay healthy. Be careful with your health. Be kind to yourself and others. And I'll see you in the next one, okay? Namo Myoho Renge Kyo. Bye for now. Hey, thank you for being here. Did you know there's a third way you can help support this channel? And it won't cost you a cent. Yep, if you are not able to be a patron on Patreon or use the PayPal me at .com at Sifu Sylvain because you don't have the financial fortune to help support this channel right now, you, as I say, always support this channel by watching, but you can also help us grow so that maybe one day we can get over 10,000 subscribers and YouTube will grace us with monetization. It's not a lot, but if you can make sure you're subscribed and share a video like a simple one, just go into the search criteria and type monk and you'll have a video that'll come up that's been up for years about what is a monk. You know, it's called monk, who, how, where, something like that. That might be a great introduction to somebody who doesn't understand what a monk is to begin with. It's a tool. Use this channel as a tool to help you with your bodhisattva practice and share a video to somebody who you think, oh, I know somebody who'll benefit from watching this. And in that way, you can help us grow. And that's a really good way to help your practice along as well. So just wanted to drop that in on you, in case that's something that you might find useful. Take care of yourself again, and I'll see you soon. Bye.